Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank of katelovingshank.com, prayerprescriptions.com, and the author of the upcoming book, Prayer Prescriptions, Spiritual Remedies for Long-Lasting Health. My guest this evening is Stan Goldberg, author of the book, Leaning into Sharp Points, Practical Guidance and Nurturing Support for Caregivers. This is a something that probably everybody can use and use well because it is a very thorough, I would say, insight into what we all must face when we are taking care of people or when they are taking care of us. Call the number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Stan Goldberg. Hello, Stan.
Hello, Kate. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Great. I loved your book. It is very intense, and I would think that difficult for some people to read.
I think so. I think most issues on caregiving and end of life need to be approached somewhat differently.
Well, first of all, I must ask you a question about, towards the beginning of the book, you talk about a doctor's responsibility to tell a person of their terminal prognosis. And it's interesting, well, as in the case of your brother-in-law, for instance, it seems to me that there's varying schools of thought on that, but I can understand your point of view. I mean, if somebody is really no doubt on their way out, as it were, they do need to know so that they can tie up loose ends, as it were.
Well, I think that's true definitely for myself and for most of the people that I know. But I think there is a danger in that what we think is good for us, we assume is good for everybody else. And I found that doesn't necessarily work. I think in terms of letting people know a terminal prognosis, if you as a caregiver are the person who is responsible for making that decision, as happens quite often, I think you need to know the history of your loved one's fears and understanding about end-of-life issues. So sometimes it is correct to let them know. Other times it isn't.
Yeah, well, it seems that becomes apparent that the person must know, that it becomes a very intimate and loving experience for the two people who are involved in that, or maybe more, the family, because facing death is something that people need to feel that they have support in that endeavor, journey.
The difficulty is that often caregivers and also their loved ones only start dealing with end-of-life issues when a person's end of life is relatively close. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when that happens, when there isn't much time, quite often the time necessary to try to get into that isn't sufficient. And we end up with very difficult situations.
Yes. And, we might end up with the person not fully taking care of the people they're leaving behind because they didn't have time to do it. That would just be one practical thing.
Sure. Absolutely.
So you have a beautiful statement here I'd like you to explain to our listeners The world of caregivers and the world of the terminally ill are very different. So and you actually go through a lot of the book explaining that. So explain that to us.
Yeah, I think that what tends to happen is as someone becomes a caregiver, they look at the situation that they're sharing with their loved one as one in which, you know, we both share equally, that we both have the same perceptions of what's going on. And I think that belief quite often leads to a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of anger and hostility, because mm-hmm. something that the loved one is doing is misinterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think one of the examples I gave in the book was there was a woman who gave up her career in order to care for her father.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, she had a great job, and she gave up also her social status. And she did everything for her father, and who was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. And he would get angry with her when his dinner was 10 minutes late.
Mm-hmm.
She misinterpreted that as ingratitude. For him, though, it was a statement of being unable to control anything in his life. So
right.
you had one behavior that was serving two different functions. And those things happen quite frequently. And what I suggest in caregivers that I counsel is that you need to think about what a person's world, how a person's world is perceived through the eyes of the illness and the eyes of the loss that that individual
mm-hmm.
suffers. And when you do that, you tend less to have the possibility of misinterpreting a loved one's words or behaviors.
Yes. Well, do you find that most people are afraid to die? I mean, it seems like a lot of the examples you gave in your book sort of pointed in that direction, that there's a, well, there is the unknown, and it is a rather, well, if you don't have a sense of humor about it, it gets to be pretty burdensome. But then there is, I know that there are people who suddenly kind of get into a love vibration near the time of their death, that they would have had to get into that love vibration, you know, long before too, because that it's not like all of a sudden you change. But it does seem like a lot of the people that you describe in your book had a pretty much terror about death. Do you actually see that a lot, that kind of fear of death?
Yeah, there's definitely a fear of death, and I think I would put it in the same category as the fear of anything that's new or that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
So you have someone who, and I, you know, I can relate it to myself. When I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, there was a period
mm-hmm.
of time when the diagnosis or the prognosis was indeterminate. This was 8 years ago, so I obviously have lived past the point where I thought I would.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
even though, you know, I knew what I was facing, I still had a fear as well.
Yes.
I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what death was all about, nor what would happen afterwards.
Right.
And I think that kind of fear is something that, yes, I do see in a lot of people. But most of the people that I've interacted with I've done that after they've been admitted to hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've come to the point of understanding that they have 6 months or less to live. Now, they may understand it only on an intellectual level. They may not really have grasped that emotionally. But they're at a state in which you don't have that abject terror that you
mm-hmm.
do see when someone first learns that they have a terminal illness. But what happens, and you're absolutely right, there is a transformative event that happens once someone accepts that they're dying that does produce the kind of love and compassion and gratitude that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
For me, though, what I've always looked at is, why does that happen? It's not always related to someone's religious beliefs, because there were people who became, you know, very accepting, who had no religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. Others who did. Some had intense spirituality and others didn't. So that didn't seem to be the way of understanding what was going on. But what I did see was something that I was able to relate to what I experienced and when I was a kid growing up in Pennsylvania. You know, it was, some of the winters were incredibly cold, and before my mother sent me outside, she would dress me in many layers of clothing. You know, starting with flannel pajamas and then the corduroy pants and the three sweat, you know, on and on and on. And I needed all of that when I went outside. When I came back in again, there was no reason to have all of those things because I would be too hot. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens as someone approaches death is an identical process, but it's related to all of those things that we've learned to place on ourselves to protect us against, you know, some of the difficulties they are in living. It's all of those ego-enhancing defensive mechanisms that build up. Mm-hmm. But when someone gets closer to dying, they shed them. They no longer have a need to have a hidden agenda. You're no longer concerned about what people think of you. You're concerned about some much more fundamental issues. And right. As those layers sort of slough off, what you're faced with is an individual who is so incredibly honest about themselves and about their other people that you'll never experience that in any other setting unless it's a very young child, you know, who hasn't learned to build up all of those defenses. So for me, when I look at that increased love and peacefulness that the person who's dying develops, you know, I think of it in those terms, is that they've reverted back to the person that they were as a child before they needed all of these defense mechanisms.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. Do you think that as the caregiver or as the person present when somebody is passing over or dying, as it were, that there's a transference of this love and mystical perception that goes to the people who are at the death bed?
I don't know. I do know that, I mean, I've been with quite a few people as they died. And, you know, for me, what I experienced was a very spiritual occurrence that I really can't put into words. It was something that was so unique that it just made you stop. It just takes your breath away.
Yes.
And everyone that I've talked to who has done the same thing has the identical experience. And none of the people, are able to describe it in words.
Right. I was with my mom when she died. I just suddenly thought about this transference idea as we were talking. I had never thought about it that way. But when she passed, it was something happened to me that I really understood. I experienced true unconditional love for about 3 days, mm-hmm. where everything, I didn't have any criticism or any judgments of anybody or anything. And it was just pure love, and I know it was her gift to me, but on the other hand, it was interesting because she had suffered from her illness, and when she was a youthful person, but then when she had gotten ill, she had a lot of wrinkles in her face and so forth. Well, as she passed, as she died, this light came sort of, I guess it was an aura came around her, and all of the lines on her face disappeared. Mm-hmm. And I've heard of that before.
I've seen that with every person I've been with. There's, you know, when someone dies, there is a peacefulness that you see on their face, at least for me, that I've never seen with them because I usually come in contact with them again as the, you know, when they start dying. So I may see pain constantly on their face for 6 months. And yes, it is a transformation, a physical transformation that it appears to have occurred with a person who has just died.
Yeah, and then another wonderful experience. I mean, there's nothing like being around a deathbed, a birthing bed, or a sick bed. And I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse for 28 mm-hmm. years. So this is, and I've written a lot about those three phenomenons of the bed scenes kind of thing. And we were with my aunt when she passed, but it was a three-day deathbed vigil. And her husband had been an Episcopalian bishop, so that the people who came, the clergy came in about at one every hour on the hour to pray with her. And then we were all, it was a really wonderful scene around this bed. I mean, we were reminiscing, showing pictures. She was pretty much in a coma at that point, but you could tell that she was just enjoying this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the moment came for her to pass, you could tell that what had happened. I didn't notice this with my mother, but there was blue that started at her fingertips and started going up her body. And mm-hmm. then we all, oh my gosh, yeah, this is it. And we stood holding hands and as she passed. And the interesting thing I noticed about that was really a very powerful experience, and going back into the world was nearly impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, we had to go back about our lives, and so some of the people there had to go on a plane trip back home and stuff like that. But one of the women there said she experienced from being around that deathbed, so-called deathbed, was this upliftance that she didn't even feel like she was walking on the earth for a period mm-hmm. of several days.
Yeah. I think being with someone as they died is probably the most spiritual experience we can have other than our own deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I also think that, you know, we can't leave our experiences behind. They become part of us. And the way we interact with folks and the way that we perceive the world is through our history. And having a history of being with someone as they died is something that becomes part of you. Now, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
the result may be different in different people, but it's a very powerful event that stays with us in some ways.
Yes, and as a hospice worker, and doing the work that you've done, so have you noticed that with every death you've ever experienced?
I have, in terms of my feelings and how it's changed me, I think sometimes the effects is different on caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes mm-hmm. it's more of thank God it's over, rather than allowing themselves to be open to see what they can learn from it.
And they might feel guilty as a result of that feeling,
yes.
of course.
Absolutely.
Yes. I love what you said about surrounding the ill person with medical equipment versus removing the equipment and bringing in meaningful
mm-hmm.
things that from their lives. I mean, can you imagine? That makes so much sense, you know, being surrounded by all this drug, you know, the drug bottles, the oxygen tanks, the things that are diapers and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And how depressing that is, as opposed to just getting rid of that stuff.
Yeah.
Out of sight. Yeah.
It is, and I'm always amazed when, because most of my hospice work is in people's homes, so mm-hmm. you have a much greater latitude on what you can suggest and do in someone's home than you can in a facility. And
yes.
I'm always amazed when I go in and I see the room filled with, you know, with hospital things and chocks and diapers and whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And usually one of the very first things I'll suggest to the caregiver is let's kind of move those things from the person's sight, because a lot of the people at the point that I see them are confined to a bed or a chair, and their whole life is only what they can see. And I suggest, you know, let's kind of, you know, if you want to put it in the back of the room or somewhere out of their sight, let's try to do that and replace all of those things with things that are meaningful, things that have meant a lot to this, to your loved one. And
yes.
It's, you know, it results in, at least what I've seen, is a very dramatic change in the attitude of the person who is terminally ill. Because
you had given that example of the gentleman who had played a lot of golf, and suddenly he was in the nursing home, and he had nothing. You know, they hadn't really taken much with him to the home, and he was despondent until they brought in his golf relics, and he cheered up after that.
Yeah. It's
common
sense,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but I think what happens often, and especially happens with people that have Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and the assumption is that they're reverting back to a childlike state and really aren't aware of what's around them, so we really don't have to take these extra steps. And it's so completely wrong. People with Alzheimer's and dementia even need more of these easily identifiable objects than people without dementia, because it can trigger back some wonderful memories.
Right. And they can become lucid if they have those things around them and actually tune in to what's happening and say some very powerful things. My father had Alzheimer's, and he was pretty much in and out, you know, mentally, or just in and out. And his mind, I should say. And, you know, every now and then he would tune in and say the most remarkable things that were very beautiful. But as an Alzheimer's patient, he never was angry or abusive. Now, the people, that's a very difficult thing for the caregiver to approach that kind of abuse from the people that are changing daily in front of them. So you do speak a lot about that. How do you learn to accept somebody when they are so difficult in their last days?
Yeah, I think that there's two things that caregivers need to understand. The first we touched on right in the beginning of the interview, which was understanding that you live in a different world. The second thing, especially with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, is that the person who's having cognitive problems looks at the world very differently. There's three things that happen in Alzheimer's that affects how we understand what they're going through. Two of them are, you know, we know about, and that's problems with memory, both short and long-term memory. But with dementia, something else happens that we really don't focus on that much, and that's the loss of a sense of structure. You know, we can go into a supermarket. You go into a supermarket, and you know, okay, I get a cart, I go down the aisles, I put things in the cart, I go to the checkout, and I pay, and then I go home. Mm-hmm. And that's not written down anywhere, you know, but those are some kind of interactive rules that we know about. They're internal. Mm-hmm. We know how to do them. With Alzheimer's and dementia, that portion of the brain or that function in the brain is sometimes affected. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you may have short and long-term memory. You may have some problems. But if you don't know how to manipulate the information that's coming in, you can get frightened. You can get very anxious. I have a friend of mine who has early Alzheimer's, and he was telling me that the most frightening thing that ever happened to him was he was crossing a street, and he got to the curb, and he forgot how to get up on a curb. And it only lasted for about 10, 15 seconds, and then he realized what you do is you put your foot up. But it's those kinds of things that can cause someone that has any form of dementia to act in a way that we may not understand. And as the language function starts to leave, and it what happens is those kinds of things are damaged, the sense of organization. So often the anger that you see or the hostility from Alzheimer's has more to do with the inability to express the anxiety that someone is feeling because their world is dissolving than anything the caregiver is specifically doing.
Yes. So not to take it personally.
Right.
And to foster attitudes of acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And you had said practicing Aikido.
Yeah. Yeah, Aikido, for those who never heard of it, it's an ancient Japanese martial art. And in that martial art, what you do is instead of attacking the person who is attacking you, you very gently move their energy aside. So someone comes to thrust at you, you move them to the side. So they don't hurt either you or themselves. And in dealing with loved ones who have any sort of illness that causes that kind of hostility or fear or anxiety, the object is not to respond forcefully against it. So you don't, you know, if a loved one is telling you that you don't care for what they need, instead of arguing and saying, yes, I do, you need to think about what can I do to help them dissipate that anger. And it could be something as simple as, I'm sorry, you know, can you tell me what I can do that will help? And that would be the equivalent in Aikido of gently moving the force to the side.
Right. It seems like there could be a different energy kind of exercises to do when you're sitting in silence with somebody. You had mentioned the value of listening and the value of silence when you're with people who are dying or just, you know, kind of moving towards that state. And, you know, stuff, people don't really know how to listen in our day and age.
Yeah, well, I think we feel uncomfortable with silence. You know, we think that it's important to fill it up so the person we're talking to doesn't feel uncomfortable. And what I try to explain to caregivers is that, you know, as the person's getting, their loved one's getting closer to dying, you know, they really don't have the time or the need for small talk. And the issues they want to deal with tend to be very important and very difficult. And because of that, you know, if there's silence, we shouldn't assume that it's because they don't know what to say or talk. Silence, for many people, is a way of getting ready to deal with something that's very important.
Right. It comes down to the idea of when those feelings of not really being able to get back into the world after you've been in the presence of somebody who has passed on. Or it's just, it's so difficult to just go back into the world and do small talk or, you know, talk about the weather or things that are so mundane. And the thing is that often I wanted to say, too, that when somebody has been given the diagnosis originally of a terminal illness, that often is a person's entry point into a spiritual insight, into and a mystical insight into their lives.
It is. Also, there's another issue there that becomes the entry point to thinking about what you'll need to do in order to have an easier death. And sometimes it is getting a spiritual practice, but a lot of times there's other issues that sometimes are even more important.
And what are they?
Well, you know, there was a person that I cared for who was a devout Catholic, and And he was, you know, he was genuinely devout. And so we all thought that his death would be a lot easier because he had the spiritual practice. And one day he said to me, he said, you know, Father Joe says that, Christ has forgiven me, and but I know that she never will. And we didn't know what it was that he did, but it really highlighted the point that sometimes there are things that in our lives that are left undone or uncompleted that we carry with us to our deaths. And even with a strong spiritual practice, it may not compensate for them. The types of things that I've seen people find closure on or find that it's important to complete before they die are things like asking for forgiveness, being forgiven for something that, they did that they felt is unforgivable, offering gratitude, thanking people for what they have done to you, completing all of those loose ends. You know, these are the kinds of things that, I've seen that have made people's death more difficult. So, you know, the upshot is that as a hospice worker, I try to help people take care of these issues. As a caregiver, I think that's also important for, caregivers to do for their loved ones, is to facilitate completion of all of these loose ends. And one of the things I point out in the book is, you know, we can approach it two different ways. We can approach it in terms of theory, of, what we think will help, or we can look at it and say, what does help? What has resulted in easier deaths? And that's the approach that I took. I looked at what caregivers and patients had taught me for the past 8 years. And said, you know, there's a pattern here. There's certain things that we can do that will help our loved ones die easier. And, you know, and I realized that not only would, does it help our loved ones die easier, but it also reduced the duration and the severity of the grief that caregivers felt after a loved one died. So, you know, in the book, I go through, there's probably more than 100, and it goes from the, very simple, such as sitting next to a person and talking to them rather than standing, to the most difficult, which is giving permission for someone to die. So it isn't that you need to do all 100. But the idea is these are things that can be done based on what your loved one needs in order to make their deaths easier.
Yes. It seems like forgiveness is a huge one.
It is. It's one of the, most important.
So we, I would think, strive to practice forgiveness long before we're given a diagnosis, that's for sure.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's was the lesson that came out for me, not only in this book, but the one that I wrote prior to this, which was my memoir as a hospice volunteer, and that was called, it's called Lessons for the Living. And what I learned is that it's important to, at least for me, to live every day of my life as if it was my last day. And by doing that, you know, I try not to leave anything on the table. So if I've done something that has offended someone, I want to ask for forgiveness then. I don't want to have to wait until it's more convenient. If someone does something nice for me, I want to thank them for it right then and there, rather than and putting it off. So that was something that, very important. So I think, I mean, what I've tried to do through my experiences is to reconstruct my own life and say, you know, the probability that I will die is probably greater over a short period of time because I have cancer than other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that being the case, do I want to wait until I have 6 months or less to live to do all those things that I've seen help people die easier, or do I want to do them on a daily basis? And I've chosen the latter. And that's how working with people who are dying and their caregivers has helped me restructure my own life.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. The life of a caregiver is very difficult, even beyond caring for a person. You mentioned how a person is pretty much not free to do very much of anything except be with the person who is his passing.
Yeah.
And so I would think they'd have to develop a sense of freedom in other ways. But ask for help. That's a very important thing.
Exactly. I think it's a given that becoming a caregiver means sacrifice. And I don't think that there's any other word that can substitute for that. There will be sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what are you going to do with that? I mean, is this something that you're going to be bitter about and
mm-hmm.
take it out against your loved one and yourself?
Right.
Or is it possible to say, this is a stage in my life, and maybe I could learn something through this experience that will help me live a better life.
Mm-hmm.
My wife had a stroke. Unfortunately, she's recovered completely. But for 3 months, 24/7, my daughter and I were her caregivers.
Yes.
And everything, and there were things that I had planned that I couldn't do because of that. And I went through all the resentment that caregivers go through, even though
mm-hmm.
I love my wife dearly, and I still do. But
right.
I experienced all of those kinds of emotions. And I think what helped me was that instead of pushing them away, I accepted them.
Yes.
And said, yes, I truly feel it's a gift that my wife has given me to allow me to care for her. But also, it's a royal pain in the neck. And to accept that both of those emotions exist side by side. Caregivers are continually stressed out. They
mm-hmm.
can, there is help, though, out there. And I think a lot of people don't realize where it can be sought. Many church groups have volunteer groups that will assist you. Virtually every one of the major disease groups, Alzheimer's, cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, etc., have some kind of assistance in some way. It may not be financial, but people may be able to send out a volunteer to your house to stay with your loved one for a couple hours a day or 3 hours a day to give you a chance to take a break. There
yes.
are online support groups that you can just log into. You can find them by doing a search. Some of them are excellent.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing with the online groups is to understand what the function of that group is. Some groups can give out meaningful advice. Other groups are just as a place to vent. So that's available. Some cities have programs where they will pay for a paid caregiver to come out to your house for 2-3 hours a day. There are lots of things available that people can find out about that will
mm-hmm.
help.
Yes, I think people are afraid to ask for help in our whole society. And one of the first things that people learn if they're in recovery is that they need to learn to ask for help. And that would be true all the way across the board. I mean, there's no reason to think that you have to be so perfect that that nobody wants to help you. Everybody wants to help. They really do. People want to be asked for to help you.
Yeah, I think that, you know, many people suffer with what I call a Mother Teresa complex,
mm-hmm.
where they think they have to be all-giving, compassionate all the time, doing everything on their own for their loved one because that's what's expected of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you read Mother Teresa's works close to when she was dying, even Mother Teresa had difficulty being Mother Teresa. So you have a situation where a lot of caregivers believe some of the things they read about how they should feel rather than really getting in touch with what they do feel. And
mm-hmm.
caregiving is probably one of the most difficult tasks anybody can do in their entire life because, you know, another person is dependent upon you for everything, for their life.
Mm-hmm.
And I
mm-hmm.
can't think of anything that's more stressful than that or anything that could produce both the joy we find in caregiving and the utter desperation.
Right. How do you suggest balancing your loved one's needs with your own?
You know, it's there's all of the common things that you hear about taking time off, about exercising, about meditating, breathing, you know, there's all of those things. But I think the answer is different for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
What I try to emphasize with caregivers is that although there's a tendency to want to sacrifice more of yourself for the needs of your loved one, what you need to understand is as you approach exhaustion, physical
mm-hmm.
or mental exhaustion, you're just not going to function as well as you did before you crossed that line.
Mm-hmm.
And because you can't function as well, you actually do a disservice to your loved one by pushing forward. So
mm-hmm.
I think you're right in the ability to ask for help is really critical. But that point at which the balance is achieved is just so different for everybody. There's no set amount. But
well, that makes sense.
Yeah, for
mm-hmm.
me the thing is, you know, you don't want to get over that point where your exhaustion impedes on the care you can give to your loved one.
Mhm. Mhm. You're right. Being exhausted is one of the number one red flags to get
mm-hmm.
help.
Right.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Tell us about the woman who had a last wishes notebook. That is so cool.
Well, you know, this was a woman that I cared for in hospice. And when I went to visit her, she said, "I want to show you something." She pulled out this notebook.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, it said, you know, last wishes notebook. And so we sat on the couch and she opened it up. And the first section was all of those very critical documents that are important for end-of-life issues. The do not resuscitate,
mm-hmm.
last will, you know, a variety of things. And all of those are mentioned in the book. And she had done all of this. And it's really critical for knowing what someone wants when they no longer can communicate that. But she also had other sections in the notebook, and they were, you know, places I want to go, things I want to do, foods I want to mm-hmm. eat, drinks I want to have. And she listed all these out, and, you know, she did this all by herself.
Mm-hmm.
And every week when I would come in to visit her, with her, she would tell me what she had done that week. And we'd sit down, and what became real apparent to me was, you know, she would say, "Well, you know, I always thought that I really wanted to go up to the Napa Valley and do the wine tasting. But when I did that, you know, I did that, and I found, geez, that wasn't as enjoyable
mm-hmm.
as sitting in my backyard, you know, tending my roses."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you had those kinds of things that occur. There are other people that I were with that would have a goodbye party. And goodbye parties were some of the most joyful events I ever went to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
the actor, the story of the actor with all of his, it's sort of a dramatic party.
This was a San Francisco actor who decided he wanted to have a goodbye party because he didn't want to have all of his friends celebrate without him there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this glorious event. And it's, you know, goodbye. People are reluctant to suggest a goodbye party because you think that it says to the loved one, okay, we know you're going. Well,
mm-hmm.
you know, loved ones know they're dying.
Yeah.
And there is nothing more uplifting to someone who is dying than to have a room full of people saying, you've made a difference in my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And all that love.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what was a great send-off.
Absolutely.
And you also said that that dying is a community event. Well, that the party is a good example of that.
Yeah, we tend to think about dying as something that happens to a single person in a single moment of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it really isn't. It transcends time, starting, you know, with a terminal diagnosis all the way through to the grief of a loved one. And it affects anyone who's had contact with that person. And I think if you start thinking in terms that this is a community event spread over time, then we treat it a lot differently than thinking about it isolated for a specific person at a specific moment of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes sense, too. And as far as acceptance goes, that kind of reminds me of forgiveness, where you want to start the act of forgiveness long before you have a diagnosis, but it would be the same with acceptance. How do you practice acceptance?
Well, I think that it really was taught to me when I started understanding that my sense of what's right and wrong is only my sense of what's right and wrong. And these values that I have are based on what I've experienced in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't expect anyone to have those values just because I think they're right.
Yeah.
And when I came to that realization, I was able to be more accepting of behaviors that I couldn't imagine doing than
mm-hmm.
I was prior to that. I mean, one of the people that I cared for in hospice had grew up in Alabama in the 30s
mm-hmm.
and was still a segregationist, hated Jews, Northerners, communists, you know, Northern agitators. The list went on and on, and I was the embodiment of at least 80% of the things that he hated.
Do you think he thought you were?
Oh, yeah.
You were too. Okay.
You know, and he, for me, embodied the worst I thought, you know, that people in the South were. So,
mm-hmm.
but I still was expected to care for his needs as someone who was dying. And I was able to do that by trying to put myself in his place, in
mm-hmm.
the experiences that he had for a whole lifetime, and thinking, you know, if I had grown up in Selma, Alabama in the 30s, how different would I be than I am now? And I think that kind of understanding really leads to acceptance of values and beliefs and behaviors that you would never do.
Mhm. Mhm. Was he part of the Klan, do you think?
I don't know. We never got that far.
Well, he may not admit it.
I'm sure he wouldn't have admitted it. But we had a great relationship.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, people like that can teach you so much mm-hmm. about, well, acceptance.
Yeah. You know, there's a saying that, you know, no one ever changed, you know, turned their life around sitting on a tropical beach being served margaritas. You know, I mean, that's not how we change. We change through adversity. We change when things don't quite go as we expect them to. And
yes.
In hospice and in caregiving, nothing ever goes the way you expect them to. So
right.
It is a constant learning situation.
There's so much change going on as a person is nearing the end of their lives, and that change is often confusing to everybody, I think.
Yeah, and I think that the difficulty with end-of-life issues is just when you think that you've got a handle on what the changes that occurred, it changes again. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it never stops changing. And I think a lot of people get into trouble when they expect that things will become stable. There is no stability in dying.
Right, and is it possible for... Well, I guess it is possible for a person to accept their terminal illness because it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But what can the caregiver do to help a person accept their terminal illness?
Well, I think the acceptance of a terminal illness often isn't based on the knowledge that you're dying, but rather on whether I've been able to take care of those things that have continued to give me anxiety. And those
mm-hmm.
are the things we mentioned, you know, the forgiveness, forgiving, gratitude, thank, all of those things. And the caregiver can be absolutely instrumental in helping their loved ones achieve that. You know,
mm-hmm.
there was a woman that I cared for who had left her teenage daughters for another relationship. And her daughters refused to see her as she was getting close to dying. And so what I suggested to her was, let's write them a letter. And
mm-hmm.
we'll be sure that they get it after you died. Because
right.
they'd have no contact with her while she was still living. So we spent 3 weeks, and we were able to finally write a letter. And the whole letter said, you know, I'm sorry for what I did to you. Please forgive me. I love you. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it was something very simple that I was able to do for her that caregivers can do for their loved ones on a, you know, constantly. There's lots
right.
of very simple things like that that can be done.
Stan, do you have a website where people can, you know, buy your books and contact you?
Yes. It's Stan Goldberg Writer, WRITER, .com.
Mm-hmm.
That's all one word, Stan Goldberg Writer.
Mm-hmm.
And on that website, I think I probably have about 80 different articles on caregiving, illness, recovery, joy that are free, and people, you know, can download them, share them, and whether they want. The books can be purchased directly from Amazon or independent booksellers or
New World Library.
New World Library, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I don't sell them myself. So those are all available. And you know, people can comment on any of the articles, and I respond to everybody.
You have a blog there? Do you blog regularly?
Well, I write articles. I call them articles because I don't know whether they're different than blogs. But on that website, articles will appear usually every 2 to 3 weeks.
And do you send them, do you have a list where people can opt in?
Yes, absolutely. I don't send any out unsolicited. All folks have to do is say they'd like to receive it, and they will receive the new articles automatically.
Okay, so I have your website up here. Excellent. So what I know that it's hard to pinpoint one shining lesson that you have learned from your own diagnosis of cancer, but what would you say, what stands out for as something that you've learned from your own diagnosis?
Don't wait.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very simple. One of the things that I've learned, and probably the most important thing, is we really don't know how long we have to live. And we don't know whether we'll have enough time to tell our loved ones the difference they've made in our lives.
Right.
And the usual thing we do is we kind of think about, well, I'd like to say this, but I won't, or maybe eventually. Don't wait. You do it now. Mm-hmm. And what I've found is that people who do things now, instead of waiting until things are more convenient, tend to have easier deaths because they have less to take care of as they get closer. And dying mm-hmm. is hard work, and you don't want to have lots of fluff laying around that interferes with that process of dying.
Yeah, that's right. Now, did you learn this lesson instantaneously, or was it over a process of time?
I don't think I learn anything instantaneously in life. I think that this is after I was hit over my head numerous times when I saw what happens when it doesn't occur. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's a process.
Yes, I can see that this whole process of living and dying and the birthbed, the deathbed, the sickbed is all a process of great lessons and joy and love, but it is tough. It is mm-hmm. tough. And as a nurse in labor and delivery, and also I was an OBGYN nurse practitioner for many years, we see the death of young, babies that don't make it. And that has a special kind. I'll never forget one time, you will love this. One time a mother lost her child, the baby was premature, lived for several hours and died. And I went to see her a few days later and she said, "This is one thing I would not want to take back." I mean, this experience with the child dying was the most important experience of her life, she said, and she wouldn't want it not to happen. I mean, it was a very interesting moment where we were all crying, and she was a very, very deeply spiritual person, obviously. I mean, it was very intense.
Well, you know, the title of the book, Leaning Into Sharp Points, is taken from a Tibetan saying that if we want to get over the things that we fear most in life, bring them closer rather than pushing them away.
Right.
And I think, you know, death and dying and caregiving are some of the sharpest points in life. And mm-hmm. when we mm-hmm. think about some of the horrible things we may have experienced, what it usually ends up with that from those we learned a lot about ourselves and changed.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the death of a child is incredibly difficult, but it can produce some of the most profound insights parents and relatives have because of that experience.
And then, of course, society has a very hard time with the death of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are feel very, very lonely as a result. Well, Stan, we've come to the end of the hour. I really appreciate your joining me this evening. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure being on your show, Kate.
Thank you. And I'm interested in reading your memoir as well. So I want to get a hold of that.
Okay.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm going to be playing Music for Mother and Child by Klaus C. Jensen. So have a beautiful evening, Stan.
Right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.